Good afternoon. Going from school district to back to college and campuses, this particular study is going to look at some basic behavioral characteristics and how one can sort of attract students and faculty and staff when there is no cost or availability, there is no cost involved, or there is available or access to these kinds of vaccines. Again, no relations, no financial relationships to disclose at this stage. Learning objective is to identify the factors associated with receiving H1N1 vaccination in college campus, to evaluate the application of theory into practice, and also to draw some policies based on the study results. Just to start with some brief timeline, as we heard before, the first H1N1 case was reported sometime in April or March or April of last year in the US and Mexico. And in June of last year, WHO has raised the alert level to number 6, which basically says that there is indication of widespread human infection. And even though towards the end of the fall of 2009, we got a limited availability of H1N1 vaccine, but it was very limited quantities. And towards the end of fall semester, which we saw in the previous presentation as well, that towards the end of last year, at the beginning of this year, we were able to get adequate number of H1N1 vaccine. When you look at the college campus or the college students, when it comes to participation in these kinds of vaccination, it is very disappointing when you start looking into some of these numbers. In the US, the disease burden has been heaviest among people less than 24 years of age, and CDC has identified 18 to 24 as the vulnerable group because of their age group and because of their the living conditions. The living in dorms or student housing put them in a higher risk. And also CDC has identified this age group as the as a priority group for vaccination. American College Health Association has a voluntary H1N1 tracking program where they were sort of instructed the various colleges and universities around the country to participate in disseminating some of the preventive messages, primarily hand hygiene, following some respiratory etiquettes, and or staying at home if you have any symptoms, or avoiding and getting in contact with any person who are infected. Some of the basic preventive measures were given this initial intervention program. And also towards the CDC also joined with ACHA to promote these type of basic guidelines as preventive measures. When you start looking into some of the measures that we took, the knowledge that we know of prior to 2009 H1N1, the seasonal flu and the influenza-like illnesses have a negative effect on college student performance. We know that students who have affected by these illnesses or any kind of influenza-like symptoms tend to have poor performance in their schoolwork, or also have a negative influence on their college level college attendance. These are all widely discussed in the literature. And when you start looking into the participation of college students in these type of vaccination, it's a very small proportion of students actually got vaccinated. If you look at it, it's less than 30% about college student participation. And again, it is very much, it's a highly vulnerable group because of all these conditions that we discussed about. In 2009 H1N1, when we look at it, the low adoption rates of preventive health measures to avoid contracting flu, and also there was a perception of threat important to student decisions to adopt preventive health actions. Because when you start looking into some of these articles that came out, on 2009 H1N1, you can see that there are some specific characteristics that one could relate to when it comes to student population, when it comes to their interest in getting any type of vaccination. So how did the colleges and universities respond to this health alert? Campus, many prior to vaccine availability, before maybe towards the end of fall semester or before the beginning of spring semester, campus-wide health messaging was a common phenomenon in terms of preventive measures that we talked about, placement of hand sanitizer stations. In many campuses and universities put hand sanitizer stations throughout campuses, and also case isolation when you are infected with H1N1 or have symptoms of H1N1, case isolation was another factor. And also changes in attendance policies. Many universities were instructed their faculty members to have flexible attendance policies or even cancel attendance policy because of this potential outbreak. And once the vaccine became available, then in addition to all these preventative measures, there are also vaccine awareness messaging and vaccination clinics that took place in many campuses throughout the US. Max vaccination clinic, and this particular study actually reflecting on one such mass vaccination clinic that took place in one large university in the Southwest, where this mass vaccination was provided to all students free, and $5 for faculty and staff. And what we basically used was, even though the cost is not a barrier, and availability is not a barrier, what are some of the factors that could influence these students to participate in this vaccination? That was the basic idea of the purpose of this chapter, this article. And we used the modified health belief model. Again, one of the reasons that we had to modify, this is just a cross-sectional data, and we assumed a linear relationship with these different factors. And these are some of the basic components of health belief model, like keys to actions, threat perception, benefits of action, barriers to action. So we collected data from students, faculty, and staff who came to this vaccination clinic in the waiting areas. And we also collected data from non-participating students, students from outside the clinic, students who didn't participate in the clinic. So we have two groups of students who participated in the clinic, and we interviewed them during the waiting, in the waiting area, and also we interviewed students who did not participate in the vaccination clinic. And it is a self-administered two-page survey, non-random convenience sample. We interviewed about 530 students, and for this particular paper, we used data only for the student data. We did not include the staff and faculty. No personal identifiers were collected because we are not planning on using any follow-up studies, and we did receive the IRB approval. And these are some of the independent variables that we used. We collected the demographic characteristics. We created a knowledge index, which has a Cronbach alpha of 0.71, and cues to action, some of the basic components that we saw in the health belief model. And we use the univariate statistics to understand the basic characteristics of these participants. And we use the logistic regression analysis to understand the odds of receiving H1N1 vaccine. And we used SPSS software for the statistical analysis. I don't know if you can see this table. These are some of the background characteristics of the preliminary characteristics of the respondents. When you look at it, about 44% of the students received a vaccine through this clinic. Majority of them are females, and majority of the students were Hispanics, because this school that we conducted is predominantly minority-majority students living, and about 20% of the students were living in dormitories or student housing. Facilities, the average age of the respondent was roughly 22 years. And you can see other numbers. We can see there is a 40% or roughly 41% of the students were aware about the friends or family received H1N1 vaccine. and almost similar percentage of students know that they know someone who got sick with H1N1. And there are some other characteristics that we can look at it. And these are the odds of receiving H1N1 vaccine. And we got some interesting results. What we found is that the students' self-perception or the susceptibility is a major factor in receiving. If they know that they are susceptible to H1N1, then their chances of becoming or getting this vaccination was pretty high. It is also true that family and friends, if they know someone who got H1N1 or if they know someone who got sick with H1N1, are some of the background factors that also influenced these students to get this vaccination. We also found that there are the basic knowledge has no effect at all, at least in the general, at least specific to this group. And we also found that the likelihood of catching N1N1 was also a significant factor. The benefits, of course, have a very significant influence on receiving H1N1 vaccine. Higher the benefits, the self benefits, they're more likely to get vaccinated. Just going back to the learning objectives revisited, to identify the greater odds of students who are being vaccinated, we can actually draw some interesting results that even though the cost and the availability were controlled, there are some other factors that actually played in these students receiving H1N1 vaccine, and which include primarily their susceptibility, their how much they know about, how much they are being threatened by this flu, or the chances of them getting the flu. Or also you can think in terms of how much they know about others getting this vaccine, or others, someone who know got sick from H1N1. So again, family members, peer groups also play a significant role in terms of seeking or getting vaccine. In terms of policy implications, it's also interesting to see that in many vaccination studies, cost and availability are two major barriers that we often see in many in general health-seeking behaviors. But in addition to, if you control availability and cost, we can also see some other factors in terms of the peer influence, the individual perception towards these influenza may also play a significant role in terms of. So when it comes to developing intervention programs, one of the things that we are able to draw from this preliminary analysis is that creating awareness among students is very important. And awareness may be through family to student or peer to peer. Awareness campaigns may influence or attracting more students to get this vaccine. Thank you. These are some references and these are some contact information.
Thank you. Now we can take questions if anyone has any questions for any of the presenters today. Questions in the back?
I have a question directed at the Laredo presentation. In terms of your parental consents, did you send home with parental consents first, or did you make the parents come to the facility, the school, and then sign the parental consent at that time?
The question was, did we have the parents come to the school to complete consent forms? We did do that. The reason for doing that was that our population has the literacy level in our population is not high, it's quite low. We also felt that if we could remove the time barrier, clinics were only 2 hours in length. So by pre-consenting, what we did was open a pre-consenting window from 7:30 in the morning until 5 in the afternoon with a team that sat there and pre-consented the parents, met the parents, and filled the pre-consent forms. We had one day at each school for that. Then if parents couldn't come in that time window, they could later come with a school nurse to fill out the form.
So if I understand you correctly, parents came to the pre-consent person, and then later on, like the next day, they came to get back, the kids came to get vaccinated?
Correct. We collected the pre-consents, and then later on, we pulled students from class. We organized the pre-consents by schedule, pulled the students from class, and vaccinated them.
And in your high school population, same thing, that they would have to, same situation, as opposed to like an 18-year-old having, could consent, or having a young adult, well, their parent didn't want to consent, they wanted the vaccine.
The 18-year-old can pre-consent for his or herself. In fact, we're doing that now and recruiting that population in one way to try to increase our secondary participation rates.
But you didn't find the younger generations in high school, or like the younger students in high school trying to forge signatures or parents, that sort of thing?
No, we didn't, but we rely on the student IDs. So we do use student IDs. One of the reasons we did pre-consenting with secondaries and didn't try to use parents coming to the school and pulling students was that we have security issues. We're on the border. You all probably have heard about our drug cartel violence. So we wanted to have a limited area where we consented parents and pre-consented and not having to move parent to go find student, then go to the vaccination clinic. So it was a model that worked well.
Another question.
Actually, you guys have a question for you.
Okay.
You talked about the 1,864 doses that were the second dose for mm-hmm. younger children. Was that, what prevented you from having a higher uptake for the second dose? Was it vaccine availability, or did you come to the end of your 7 weeks?
No, it was actually right in the, like, the last week in November, or it might have been the third week of November. We ran out of vaccine. They did not have any more, didn't know when we'd have enough, and so we needed to be able to get to all of the schools. So they thought that they may not even be getting any more vaccine until after Christmas, and we only had until December 17th to complete our vaccine. Yes.
And that probably brings up a question going back to a year ago for all of these school districts: is how did these states how was that whole supply allocation?
How did they allocate
program? How was that determined?
The allocation was
figure out how many needed versus how many.
Yeah. It was every state was allowed to allocate how they saw fit according to different age groups. Our state, we've got a lot of villages, and so they had to be really careful that Anchorage didn't get everything, because that's the common thing. We're the largest city in the state. We have about 350,000 people, but the most common thing that they get is Anchorage gets everything, whether we do or not. So they had to talk with each of the villages and see how many students they have, how many children, how many pregnant women they had, how many in the high-risk groups, kids with asthma, people with asthma, and then come up with some way to determine how many vaccines went to each location. The vaccines that went to our city also went to the health department, also went to the private providers. We didn't necessarily agree that that was the best way to do it, and I think afterwards the state wasn't sure that they had done it in the best way, because all the kids go to school in one of the major areas. So rather than giving it to individual practitioners, of which there are hundreds, on the chance that over the next 6 months they would get kids into their clinics or offices, it didn't turn out as well as I think they had hoped, because we saw kids within a 7 week period rather than looking at a 6 month period. At the end, they had too much vaccine because they couldn't use it. And we could have used so much more than we were given. So, I don't know if anyone else want to comment on that.
Our state had a similar experience in terms of allocating the vaccines. Vaccines were allocated to private providers, to health departments, and to other agencies like federally qualified health centers. From my perspective, the first distributions went to private providers. This, in a medically underserved area like Laredo, was very difficult. because providers hesitated to sign up for the vaccine. They were already overwhelmed with their regular clinic visits. So we really had to have a push and write some letters and do a little advocacy through our legislators to get the vaccines pushed towards public health department, because they could work with the schools to get the vaccines out that way. So I think in the states, Alaska probably learned, Texas also learned through the experience, how we would allocate vaccines again in if a future pandemic occurs.
More questions? Anyone else? Great. Well, thank you so much for coming. And we, I think the presenters will be here for a few minutes. But...